Lynn Sacco, thanks for coming in today.
Hi, Todd. Thanks for having me.
Where did you originally come up with an idea for an entire academic course about Dolly Parton?
Honestly, it just came into my head one day, the title Dolly Parton's America. I was thinking about teaching students here. I was thinking about teaching them history as something interesting, something that's not just about big, important people like presidents. And I thought, wouldn't it be amazing for them to explore what is their own history or heritage in this region? But I put that idea aside for a while because I was teaching other things. Then I read a book from the University of Chicago that came out on an ebook the other year, and all of us were reading it in the apartment, and it's by a woman called Helen Morales. It's called Pilgrimage to Dollywood. She is actually a classicist faculty member in England, although now she's at the University of California, Santa Barbara. And she just had a love of Dolly and a love of Tennessee country music. So it turned out she had a one-year appointment, and she worked in an entire trip to travel, drive through Tennessee, and visit Dollywood. And that's when I got the idea that I could really open up this course to make it not just, I didn't want to sort of affirm the idea that this is a provincial kind of examination looking at East Tennessee or Appalachia. This way, it could actually bring it out to the world, which really created the key question. How did this little girl from East Tennessee become a one-word meme internationally?
Now, when you conceived of the course, did you have to go sell it to the history department? And was it an easy sell? Or
I didn't have to sell it to the department. They thought it was a terrific idea. I had taught in history of cinema previously. I also taught a course just in the history of popular culture in the 20th century as a different way to look at the 20th century and as a way to introduce students to popular culture as something to think about rather than just treat like the weather. We're often raised to think popular culture is junk. That's what my parents always called it. And we should avoid it, but it's unavoidable, particularly with social media. So I like to use the example of my mother. She doesn't have a computer. She's going to be 87 this year. She knows what Skype is. She knows what Yelp is. She calls me and says, look this up on Yelp for me. And I said, how do you know all of this? And she said, it's on morning TV. They have, and I've watched it with her now. They have somebody sit there with a computer. They show what Skype is. So you don't even have to go to a movie to know what it's all about. It penetrates our culture everywhere. So I wanted students to think of those sources instead of what they think of as traditional history sources, diaries, famous people's speeches, battlefields.
You know, it's interesting you talk about popular culture and the different views of it. I mean, jazz music itself started out as very much just considered just sort of just like a disposable type of music, and country music, hillbilly music, or whatever you want to call it, Appalachian music, bluegrass, all of those forms were really looked down upon by some, but they seem to be gathering much more credibility as in these are best exports. Why did that change, especially through the lens of something like Dolly Parton, who also was probably even ridiculed by her peers?
One of the key ideas that a lot of scholars came up with at the end of the 20th century was, looking back, there is not really the same clear-cut difference between what we might think of as high culture versus low culture. And it turns out that what we think of as high culture now, such as Shakespeare, used to be low culture. There's a book by Lawrence Levine where he talks about William Shakespeare in America, and troops would perform Shakespeare locally and change the words to the plays. For instance, Trump's name might appear in a play now, or Kaz Walker might appear as a name in a Shakespeare version. Opera was low culture and became high culture. And there's reasons the way this happens is not accidental. It's usually some high society people who decided that the lower people need to have their morality and other qualities raised. And so when they decided that Shakespeare would become more expensive, working men actually rioted because they couldn't get into the theater in the 19th century. So part of contextualizing Dolly is to rid them of the idea that only high culture is important, because in fact, popular culture really engages, many more people engage with popular culture than I'm guessing go to opera, and I love opera. And so it's not really about the quality of Dolly's work per se in sort of an art appreciation way. It's why is she so popular? Why, for decades, does this woman have this ability to turn her roots, her identity, into a performance identity that is very convincing to people? So what I mean by that is she didn't just start out as a twangy singer with a guitar, like in the first in her first appearances where she's singing How Great Thou Art. She starts to dance around the stage. She sings all kinds of kind of pop music. The theme, that song that Whitney Houston made so big, I can't think of the
name. I'll Always Love You.
I'll Always Love You, right. That's a terrific example. She takes her songs there. She does Broadway plays with them, movies. So she's in a lot of popular arenas in terms of entertainment, but I think she's been almost as influential as Disney, which I know is a huge claim. But Dolly doesn't put her mark on it all just the same. You can tell a Disney product, but did you know that her production company was part of the team that put together Buffy the Vampire Slayer on TV? That's where I say she's involved in a lot. She changes with the time. She's not just up there singing oldies from the 70s. She's very dynamic. So how does she balance this identity that's all around heritage, in a sense, with being able to change with the times? It's a very unusual quality, I think, in any performer.
You know, as a native East Tennessean, we always saw her as one of us, and we're really cheering for her,
right?
You know, to make it. I've always felt that thing of like, and when she started doing this Hollywood thing, you know, I know there were those that are going, oh, you know, 9 to 5, that's not the real Dolly Parton. But there were another camp of people going, that would be great if she could figure out a way to be great in movies. And we loved, you know, when she would be on The Tonight Show and things like that, because it just felt like, oh, one of our folks, you know, broke through.
Right.
And she had this amazing amount of respect from people like Johnny Carson when they were being interviewed. It wasn't, they didn't, I never got the feeling they were looking down on her.
No, she's not treated as a joke. She was even on the cover of Playboy magazine, which would seem to me, as somebody not from this area, would be disqualifying to her. But it seems as though no matter what she does, everybody respects her here and outside of this area. Nobody mocks her. I've never seen, and I've intensely researched her now, I don't see gossip about her. I don't see people writing ugly things. I don't see unattractive pictures posted. People respect her. They respect her privacy. And I think it's because she treats everybody from East Tennessee and everybody else, she just treats everybody with, I guess I would say, love and respect. She doesn't seem to be elitist at all. And I think that's, she doesn't talk down to her people. She doesn't talk down to anybody. And I think that keeps people from talking down to her.
How is she able to pull it all off? I mean, really, because you're talking about succeeding on any number of fronts that are usually battlefields of business disaster, you know, theme parks.
I know, she's amazing. Really, she really is. She is one of the most successful business people. And I say this in Tennessee with our governor and his family, but she really is one of the most successful entrepreneurs probably in Tennessee history with all of the different business dealings she had. I mean, think about how she sort of saved Pigeon Forge when she bought the amusement park there. Now, what she did is she bought it with this family that also runs the amusement parks in Branson, Missouri. So in a sense, she's tapped into what's called Christian entertainment. Very smart. But one of the questions we asked in class is, how come she's so popular with people not from this region? But you come to Dollywood, there's no alcohol, there's a Bible store, it's very clear what the culture is here, and I notice she doesn't bend for that. She doesn't allow alcohol because it'll make tourists happier. So I think that's the idea that people visit East Tennessee to appreciate our culture, our people, and our heritage. And I know that heritage is a tricky word, so I'm not ignoring that. But it's not made for to be something it's not. She doesn't compromise. Dolly says about her performances, I give people what they want. I sing what they want. I tell stories that they want. Everybody I've talked to thinks they know her. They go, oh, I feel like I know her. And I say, you don't know her. And people get very upset. But she only says like five different things about her life all the time. She says the same things. But here's a woman that doesn't live with her husband, doesn't have children, doesn't go to a church, tells off-color jokes at her concerts, and then breaks into a hymn. And all of that inconsistency just seems to add to her charm. So whereas if she was left here and said, well, I'm better than everybody now, I'm a Hollywood person, I think her fan base would have dried up. I think it's the fact that she retains this I'm just a normal person idea that makes her so popular. Now, how she got through dealing with all those sharky people out there, I don't know. Sandy Gallen was her manager for many years. She's written about him, how important he was. Even in his obituary, they talked about Dolly. So she has been able to ally herself with a lot of people who were also very successful in business. But I think that she's probably somebody of her word, and she has a particular image, and she doesn't negotiate that. And I think that probably it was like take it or leave it, people. And she's valuable enough that she got to call the shots. That's really quite impressive.
Her philanthropy also has been one of those things that is just kind of unassailable because it seems so genuine. But one of my first memories as a student at the University of Tennessee, I was paying my tuition at the bursar's office when you would do it analog style, you know, with a check. And I would go down and pay with a check and give it to a person.
Who would write out a receipt.
Yes, right. And I would then lose the receipt. But the person, I remember one time there was a person in front of me and they were paying their tuition with a check. And I looked over their shoulder and their tuition check was from Dolly Parton. I mean, I could see it. And so there's one of my first impressions, you know, as a young man thinking like, oh, she does things like that. What can you tell us about her philanthropy and how that's also worked into all of this?
Students mention her philanthropy constantly. As soon as they say, I love Dolly Parton, then they talk about her books. I think almost every student I talked to about Dolly remembered getting her books, and that left such an impression on them. They never talk about any other kind of philanthropy from her, however. But when the fires happened in Gatlinburg, I was waiting to see which famous people from the state would step up, and I was completely not surprised when it was Dolly. And I thought, who else? She's sort of unimpeachable because she stays out of politics. She doesn't take sides in things, and she's just for what she calls her people. I can't think of a better person to do philanthropy here. That said, I think she just doesn't talk about a whole lot of it. She has made a point about how she is a job creator out there, how she gives a lot of money to friends and family, gives jobs to friends and family, and I'm certain she does. But I also think she must do a lot that we don't know about. You know, she doesn't boast about her wealth. She's never on these lists of wealthiest people. But she must have accumulated quite a lot. And it would not fit in with either her image or what we know about her as a person that she just sits home counting it. The way I found out she had been involved in Buffy was a story I read in the LA Times by a woman who's a producer out there and suddenly got a call from Dolly recently. And who said, I want to have lunch. And the woman was like, I don't know, Dolly. This is thrilling. And at lunch, Dolly pulled out a check and said, I found out that when Buffy was over, the production company, all the guys said they made it even, you know, gave everybody an even share. But I found out yours was less. And she gave her a check and said, here's the difference, out of the blue. That story seems completely believable to me.
Who can take this course? And I imagine it's going to be, if it's not popular already, it's going to be extremely popular. What students are allowed to take it and which ones can't?
Well, let me say, you know, you asked me earlier whether I had to sell this course. The department asked me last year if I could create a new course that would really get students eager to take it. So let me say that this vastly exceeded my and everybody's expectations. But I have found that students like to talk about a popular culture because they can't believe they get to take a class on it. That said, this course is a very particular course. It is a course that's for history honors students, And it teaches them how to use primary and secondary sources, which is the bread and butter of our profession, how to look at them, how to think about them, how to put them in context, and then ultimately they have to write a paper using these sources. So it's kind of a nerdy methods class in a lot of ways. And DALI is, my idea of using DALI for this was to find some way to keep the students interested in the subject matter so they wouldn't just go nuts thinking about methods.
Is there some part of this class that you feel helps people to wade through, as a byproduct of learning about DALI and history, wade through the mass of information out there to get to some really useful, interesting, accurate things?
Absolutely, because as historians, we don't get to say anything that we can't back up. But when you look at documents, you're not often sure what it means. And most people also are complex, and, you know, some days I'm really generous and some days I'm really selfish. So how do you write stories about people in the past that can sort of embody those complexities? Because normally what we try to do is try to erase it so we could say one thing about somebody. But people aren't flat, thank God. One of the responses from the students that most surprised me, at first I was a little alarmed and I realized it was a good thing. They said that about halfway through the course, one by one, they kept saying, "I feel like I don't know anything anymore. I feel like my whole world has changed." And at first I was a little alarmed, and then I realized that they were having an existential crisis. And I thought, what could be better? Because school should upturn you. I often tell them, you know, when they come in and talk about how politicians accuse faculty of brainwashing them, I say, well, were it only so, you would all get A's and classes would last 1 week, semester would last 1 week. But the thing is that you can examine things you think you know about in order to understand why you do appreciate it. So everybody felt they grew up with DALI. They appreciated her, but they didn't know why. They didn't know why she was so popular. They just, you know, she's like weather here. But why would somebody in China be a fan? Why would somebody in England be a fan? What was DALI's effect on their life? And whatever they thought about themselves as Tennesseans, and it happened, one student was from from Virginia, but she considers herself Appalachian. They all felt like they knew DALI, but when they realized they didn't, or that the story was more complicated, it caused them to reflect on what else they thought they knew. And at the end of the course, students who had been somewhat ambivalent about DALI beforehand all said the same thing. I love DALI, her. Because now that they could actually talk through five reasons why they appreciated her, that appreciation was much more meaningful. I often tell students to not fear things that they feel uncertain about, but to explore them more intensely. I've had many students, for instance, even many they have a father who's a pastor, and they get to college and they're not certain about their religious beliefs. And they talk to me and say, you know, it's one thing to be born in a church and believe, you just grow up that way, you don't think about it. It's another thing to stop to think about it, and then to decide to embrace it is much more powerful. So I try to get students in all of my classes and in personal discussions not to fear facts, but to think about how they are useful and why they are politicized.
You know, this class is now not just known to those of us here on campus. You've been featured in the New York Times, and I know the BBC is wanting to talk to you. Why do you think this idea of this class resonates on such a level?
I think it's just because DALI is so popular. Really, DALI retweeted a tweet that went out from UT about the course. And within hours of DALI's tweet, I was being inundated by reporters. I've got the Australian Broadcasting Service has even contacted me. I've been contacted by all kinds of teachers, college, high school, people that do things for seniors. I've been contacted by people that just love DALI. I've never had a response to anything like this before. I don't think any of us anticipated this, but it's just because she sent a tweet.
Yeah, and her tweet said, "From the girl voted in high school least likely to succeed, this sure is a blessing." That has to feel pretty neat.
I bet it does. You know, I remember at graduation, she came out there and she just wept while she was awarded that degree. And she made that statement, and then she talked to the students in what I thought was the best graduation talk ever. And she said, there's a difference between hopes and dreams. And I often get confused which is which, but she said, hope is something you get out of bed and you hope it happened overnight, like breakfast is on the table. A dream is something you get out of bed and you work really hard at every day. And I thought, she can say that because she lives that.
Do you have plans for any other courses along this line or in this vein, or is... How are you going to top this, you know?
I don't know how I could top this, really, unless I just made it a bigger course. My other courses are less fashionable to speak about and not as easy. So, for instance, the other course I'm teaching this semester is actually the history of rape in the United States. It's a very difficult course to do the readings. It's a difficult course to talk about every day. But I'll tell you, the students in that class love it, even though it is day and night compared with the Dolly material, because it's giving them an opportunity to explore hot button issues today, but look at it historically and really kind of think through arguments. A lot of times people feel they're for or against something, but they can't explain why. In my classes, they have to explain why. They learn how to explain why. Tell them that's the point of being an educated person. You don't just say, I just feel that way.
Right. And the Dolly Parton course will be offered this fall.
Yes. It's a part of History 307, which our department offers every fall. It's an opportunity then for students who want to go on and write a year-long senior paper. There's History 408 in the spring where they start working on it. Then they come back after the summer and they do some research in the summer. And then in the fall, they write it up so that if they're applying to graduate school, they have a complete writing sample. And they've actually spent three semesters of concentrating on this, including the summer.
What would you say to, say, someone like the 19-year-old me who would come to you and go, I would benefit from this course so immensely. This is right up my alley, but I'm not an honor student. In fact, I'm not even close. Won't you let me in?
I'd say work harder and come back in a year.
Someone should have told me that. Anyway. Are you a Dolly Parton fan, especially in terms of her music, and were you before?
I wasn't a fan until I saw her at graduation, and I've been a big fan ever since.
Your favorite Dolly Parton song?
Jolene.
You can't go wrong with that one. Lynn Sacco, thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Todd. What a pleasure.